We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Nagy.
May it please the court.
Mr. Robert.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court. I want to be clear in terms of what the issues are here and what they are not. This is not a case where the actual exercise of discretion by the government is at issue. It's the fact that the court below had a complete lack of ability to exercise discretion. I've outlined six separate issues, many of which I acknowledge are perhaps foreclosed by Seventh Circuit precedent, but just as Freddie Booker had to walk through this courtroom, or at least this counsel did, on the way to the United States Supreme Court, so must Mr. Nigg. I understand that in this case, it seems to be fairly straightforward as an application of the Armed Career Criminal Act. Specifically, as it relates to Mr. Nigg, he had three counts worth of convictions for violent felonies that did qualify as predicate offenses to kick in the Armed Career Criminal Act mandatory sentencing provisions. These are offenses that date back to the year 1976, and the convictions themselves occurred in 1977 when Mr. Nigg was approximately 21, 22 years old. One of the issues that we raised is how the court below chose to view the evidence that was presented by the prosecution. And just by way of background, of course, when we look at a separation of powers issue in a case such as this, all circuits, as well as the United States Supreme Court, have held that this is the kind of tool that's valuable for a prosecutor to have in their tool bag in order to encourage people not to go to trial, in order to have the threat of an enhanced sentence out there. Well, in this case, as the court can see, Mr. Nigg pled guilty, and this is not a scenario where that rationale would necessarily apply. With regard to the due process arguments that I've raised, I think these are the ones that are most important in the sense that we have statutory language represented in 18 U.S.C. 3553A and in 3661 that mandate a court to exercise discretion, which feeds back into my separation of powers argument. If the judiciary is to perform its function correctly, another statute that completely removes the judiciary from the process is in conflict. And applying the rule of lenity, which I have also discussed in my brief, the correct way of fashioning how those conflicts come down should go in favor of leniency rather than harshness.
Counsel, how can there be a how can you explain that there's a violation in light of the Supreme Court's holding in cases like Chapman versus United States that recognize that Congress does have the power to define criminal punishments without giving the courts any sentencing discretion?
Well, I think what's different about the particular scenario presented in this case that hasn't been addressed in a lot of the others that have gone up, for example, how if we look at the whole line of cases, starting with Apprendi, Blakely, Booker, Almendarez, Torres, that all deal with the fact that the fact of a prior conviction is not within the realm of a guidelines analysis or an entitlement to have the guidelines be optional and therefore the court exercising its discretion. Certainly, Congress has that role in defining what crimes are and what appropriate penalties are. But this is a particular statute, which, by the way, to my knowledge, is the oldest one that mandates any kind of mandatory minimum sentence without regard to any judicial discretion, that requires the prosecutor, essentially, to make a decision about what the sentence ultimately will be.
One?
I'm not sure about that.
You must understand that every criminal statute passed by the first Congress and probably through the 1840s required mandatory sentences. Every person who robbed a post office had to be sentenced to exactly 25 years in prison, neither more nor less. That was the norm when this nation was created. This was so far from being the original one.
And
what you're asking us to hold
old,
is that every criminal statute passed by the first Congress is unconstitutional.
No, I am. I'm aware of that, Your Honor. But this is, and I may be wrong in this, but I meant the oldest one that's in effect right now that's applying to criminals that are facing sentencing. The laws that the court just referenced are not requiring mandatory minimum sentences in these in 2011. So my point being, to address Judge Pratt's question, is that, yes, indeed, Congress does have that power. But where it goes beyond the point of defining what the crime is and what the parameters are, and Congress also wrote Section 3553A and Section 3661, which contains the word shall. The court shall, without limitation, consider all of the characteristics of a defendant. And in 3553A, it mandates that certain language be addressed, certain factors be addressed, and it enumerates them. It's a court's duty. That's where the judicial function lies. In this case, as the court can see, not only did the court have really no discretion with regard to determining sentence, but even submitted a letter or as part of its ruling on a previous defense motion requesting why the government felt that it was appropriate to proceed in this way. He did so in a very respectful manner, and I acknowledge that. But in terms of highlighting why this is such a continuing problem, I did also raise in the court below, and I think it is worth talking about because there are so many cases spread throughout the circuits. I will acknowledge the Seventh Circuit case on point here is not especially helpful, but still distinguishable. And that is whether or not the spirit of the Armed Career Criminal Act and the rationale behind punishing the worst of the worst is applicable in a case with such remoteness and such evidence of rehabilitation having occurred in this matter. We are talking about three convictions that did occur simultaneously, although they do relate to events that were somewhat spaced apart. But again, the difference here, and I was unable to find a Seventh Circuit case on point here, is that this is a conspiracy allegation. He was a party to the crime with this other individual that was clearly the ringleader. There's the only evidence we really had in the record is the fact that he was a follower, not so much of a leader, and was involved in some way. Now, the crimes that he's convicted of, although a party to the crime, certainly are, and we make no distinction, we make no argument that they are not crimes of violence. That is not the issue. It's his specific role with regard to that that creates the problem, because he jumps from a person that has no criminal history category whatsoever. He scores a zero under the sentencing guidelines, and therefore his felon in possession of a firearm sentencing range would have been 12 to 18 months. And that's incorporating all of the wisdom and guidance, research, empirical, and otherwise, that the United States Sentencing Commission has incorporated into the United States Sentencing Guidelines to give us a starting point from where we should look at this, considering things like the passage of time, rehabilitation, and so forth. So the Armed Career Criminal Act bypasses all of that. And then in terms of whether or not these three prior convictions should kick this in or not, it's a difference between, you know, 1 week or 10 days or so in a man's life when he was 21 years old and now a 15-year sentence versus 12 to 18 months. I did discuss particularly, and I think it's important to point out in my brief, that a close examination of the statutory language itself does reveal that we have competing language here. There is specifically the language that is in the prefatory language under 18 U.S.C. 3551 that uses except as otherwise specifically provided. Then we are referred to 3553A. The question then becomes, does 924 and 922 specifically provide for this? And we see language in 922 that indicates notwithstanding any other provision of law, which is after the term that someone shall be fined and imprisoned not less than 15 years. So my point is that basic statutory construction is such that if you look at the part where the trial court is having discretion removed, there is an argument here that the court could interpret it as such. This court has de novo review power over statutory construction. There is an Eighth Amendment argument there, and I acknowledge that even cases where the death penalty is imposed it's not necessarily, of course, cruel and unusual punishment. My point here is that under the circumstances of this particular case, and I think under Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, which nowadays there isn't that much, you know, except as it relates to mentally incapacitated people and so forth, but under the particulars of this case, it's not just what the punishment is, but what the circumstances of the crime are and the fact that we have other statutory authority for what the appropriate sentence should be that competes with existing statutory authority. I will reserve the balance of my time. It looks like I'm actually done, so thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fennell.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I don't have any arguments to present this morning outside my brief. I'm content to use the time that I have here to respond to any questions that the Court may have. Otherwise, I would simply ask you to affirm the sentence of the District Court.
It doesn't look like you're going to be peppered with questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fennell. Mr. O'Bear, I wouldn't say there's much you need to respond to.
That makes my rebuttal off.
Well, Mr. O'Bear, thank you very much for accepting the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement.